UEG Talks, gastroenterology to go. Welcome to our GI podcast. Listen for fresh insights and perspectives in science, education, and professional development.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the second part of our discussion on esophageal cancer, mainly with the preventative aspect. My name is Pradeep Mundry, and I'm your host for today. The last time on this show, I invited Professor Massimiliano Di Pietro to talk about prevention of esophageal cancer. Mass is a professor of gastroenterology and consultant gastroenterologist at Cambridge University Hospitals. Mass has dedicated his research to early esophageal cancers and dysplasia. He's also the lead author for the British Society Barrett's Guidelines and the NICE Guidelines, and also author of the European Society of Gastrointestinal Endoscopy Barrett's Management Guidelines. Last time on the show, Massey talked about the epidemiology of esophageal cancer, how the treatment of esophageal cancer has changed over time, and if there was a potential for prevention of esophageal cancer. If you haven't listened to the previous episode, I encourage you to do so, as this episode would be a continuation of that, and then come back to this one. Let's say we made a diagnosis of Barrett's and you're seeing the patient in clinic. So you want to counsel them. So, well, because I want to tell them what's the risk of developing esophageal cancer from Barrett's. So what is the overall risk? And are there anything within the Barrett's that would risk stratify this risk?
Yes, so there are a lot of studies that have tried to quantify the risk of cancer in Barrett's esophagus. I generally quote the risk of 1 in 300 per year. So basically, what I tell my patients, if I have 300 patients with Barrett's, only one of them every year will develop cancer, which is a way to reassure them that, in fact, actually, that risk is pretty small. And so if you then translate into what we were discussing before, an irregular design with IM, that risk will be 1 in 9,000, which is an extremely low risk. You do have some factors in Barrett's that helps risk stratifying and quantifying that risk a little bit more precisely. And the parameter which has the most impact on the cancer risk is the length, going back to what we were discussing before about the field change. The longer is the Barrett's, the higher is that risk. There is a rough estimate that that risk increases by 10% for every centimeter of the Barrett's. And this is the reason why patients with short segment of Barrett's, so perhaps 1 or 2 centimeters only, are recommended to have surveillance every 5 years, whereas patients with longer Barrett's, 3 centimeters or more, are recommended to have surveillance every 3 years. Another factor that does play a risk is the sex. Male patients are at increased risk of cancer compared to female patients, although perhaps, probably, that risk has been overestimated. Conventionally, we said that males are at twice as higher risk compared to females. However, a recent study, collaborative studies with Dutch colleagues, have shown that females, particularly females with long segment of Barrett's, are at roughly similar cancer risk. And that increase in the cancer risk in males compared to females was only 38% in this study. So I think we can use, obviously, some factors to risk stratify the patients. And another risk factors could be, of course, obesity, because of the endocrine element that exerts some proliferative factors on the esophageal cells.
Okay, so the length is more important. Now, I'm assuming, based on the previous discussions, you might bring up family history into account here. Is that correct?
Yes. In fact, actually, you're right. As I was saying before, the family clustering does occur in both the context of Barrett's and esophageal adenocarcinoma. Therefore, family history should be taken into account when considering patient management.
Okay. The other thing that comes up when you first counsel patients for surveillance, yeah, patients are very happy to have surveillance. But the thought of proton pump inhibitors really is a bit difficult. Currently, we are educated as gastroenterologists that patients with Barrett should start proton pump inhibitors and they should stay on it long term. Is that correct, first of all? Because, you know, the patients these days are very well educated. They always see on the media the associations of PPIs with various things, including cancers. And they really ask us this question, should I be on this long term? Because let's take it this way. The patients do have reflux prior to developing Barrett's. Once they develop Barrett's, their reflux symptoms somewhat abate because it's a protective mechanism from reflux. Barrett's itself is. So they say, doc, I do not have symptoms. Why are you asking me to take a lifelong drug? So I just want to know, first of all, the evidence behind this, and how would you speak to your patients when you counsel them?
Yes, this is a very difficult topic because obviously, especially with widespread use of internet, a lot of nowadays patients are more informed about the risks and benefits of medical interventions. And I think we should go back again at what the research data show so that we can give informed responses to our patients. The majority of the retrospective studies, and I'm talking about population studies and case control studies, show that PPI do reduce the risk of esophageal cancer in people with Barrett's esophagus. Now, unfortunately, we are never going to have the gold standard evidence to confirm this, which is a randomized control trial. There is only one randomized control trial available, which is the ASPECT study, which randomized patients with Barrett's to two different doses of esomeprazole. So in one arm, there was 20 milligrams, in the other arm, 80 milligrams. And each of these two arms in this study were then randomized to either aspirin or no aspirin. Now, if we compare the two groups with different doses of esomeprazole, there wasn't any difference in the incidence of esophageal adenocarcinoma, which at the very most suggests that there is no dose effect, but does not prove that PPI are not a preventative strategy. So I think in the absence of evidence and having many retrospective studies that confirm the utility of PPI as a cancer preventive intervention, we should consider PPI as the gold standard treatment for people with Barrett's esophagus, regardless of symptoms. I think what we should be doing in clinical practice is to seek the minimal effective dose in controlling symptoms, okay? So if you have a patient which is asymptomatic, then you would be using the lowest dose of PPI. If you have a patient that has high symptom burden, then you should try and increase the dose until the symptoms are controlled.
Okay, so that's a good way. And I guess we have to be honest with our patients to say, yeah, the evidence is there, but probably not strong, and then let them make that judgment sort of thing if they question you a lot. Is that okay to say?
Yes, and of course, take into account also possible side effects. Obviously, there are some people that do not tolerate PPI. Diarrhea, for example, is one of the commonest side effects for PPI users, and there are some described electrolyte imbalances. So people that have fatigue and other unspecific symptoms, I would always recommend to check magnesium levels because there are cases of associated hypomagnesemia associated to PPI. And in females, there is a well-described slightly increase in the risk of osteoporosis. Okay, so I think this is what we should be counseling patients for. But on the other hand, I think what we should be discussing with our patients is the risks and benefit ratio. So I think the benefit of having a small dose of PPI, in my opinion, in the context of Barrett's esophagus, outweigh the risk of side effects.
Okay, that's well said, Nasi. Now, I want to talk about surveillance. You've already told us the risk of cancer is low. However, esophageal cancer is a deadly cancer. So, you know, even small benefits important in this context, unlike other cancers, maybe. In terms of surveillance, we do this and it's routine clinical practice. I just want to know, as a researcher and as an expert, how strong is the evidence for surveillance and what does the evidence show? You know, what does this improve surveillance in terms of mortality or morbidity? So how would surveillance protect us or improve patients' outcome?
Pradeep, this is a very contentious field because the evidence is conflicting. There are two large studies, one from Dutch group and one from the Northern Ireland population cohort, that show that surveillance is protective against esophageal cancer. So people that have Barrett's esophagus and are surveyed are at lower risk of dying of esophageal cancer compared to people with Barrett's that are not surveyed. But there are also two studies, case-control studies from the U.S. veteran population that do not support this evidence. So how we tease out this problem? How do we reconcile this? I think the problem is how we conduct surveillance, okay? So when we commit as practitioners to surveillance, we have to perform it in a proper way. We have to use, as we were discussing, the landmarks and the proper endoscopic classifications, but we also have to apply the gold standard diagnosis, which is the Seattle protocol biopsies. Especially in long segment of Barrett's, there is no point of conducting surveillance if we don't adhere to the standard. And the standard in this case, biopsies according to the Seattle protocol, which entail 4 biopsies every 2 centimeters. We also have to use our best imaging modalities, and there is some evidence that electronic and dichrome endoscopy can increase the pickup rate for dysplasia. So getting familiar with how dysplasia looks like on, for example, narrowband imaging or using acetic acid to delineate and identify areas of dysplasia is going to increase our diagnostic accuracy for dysplasia. And finally, the surveillance interval. So the results of the biopsies have to be looked by people that understand how to interpret that. So all these factors together will make the difference. And there is some data from the Dutch study that if surveillance is not conducted according to the standard recommendations, then we are not going to achieve the same goal of preventive strategy. So I think it's really important that we put in practice all these factors to conduct surveillance in the best way we can, and then we can see the results in terms of preventative strategy.
So I guess, you know, with increasing awareness, increasing more clear guidelines from people like you, if we repeated these studies, maybe we'll probably see a stronger evidence judging by what you're saying.
Yes, and there is some evidence that surveillance conducted in expert centers achieves a better result. Now, obviously, we cannot envisage a healthcare system where only experts will do surveillance, but perhaps in every single gastroenterologist, there has to be a strive to be aware of the guidelines, understand what is the recommendation, and put in practice that recommendation, because it's certainly going to feel us more confident about diagnosis, but ultimately it will be for our patients' benefit.
So, Massey, currently the only proposed surveillance method is endoscopy and quadrantic biopsies every 2 centimeters, Seattle protocol. Firstly, very invasive procedures, so I have to say, are there any lesser invasive options? And are they all ready for mainstream use to replace this with the current evidence?
Yes, you're right. Seattle protocol is time-consuming, and endoscopists don't really like to do that because you have a lot of bleeding and it takes time to perform. But it does remain the gold standard. There are some alternatives which have been looked at. One, for example, is the stiff brushes from the Watts 3D. These are stiff brushes designed to replace the Seattle protocol because by brushing, you can collect the cells from the surface and then ensure a more homogeneous sampling of the Barrett's esophagus. It is certainly a very intriguing and potentially useful technique. The studies show that it has a similar diagnostic accuracy compared to the Seattle protocol. If done on top of the Seattle protocol, it does increase the pickup rate of dysplasia, but you can imagine that it would be difficult to combine the two in terms of time of the procedure. And it does have the caveat that the sample has to be sent to a specialized lab in the US that applies some neural network analysis to select areas of interest and the specialized pathologies for diagnosis. So it's not a straightforward technique to apply in our standard clinical practice. I think there is increasing evidence about the use of minimal invasive disease, for example, capsule sponges, one of them being the cytosponge. And there is currently a study which is going on in the UK where we are looking at the diagnostic accuracy of capsular sponge for dysplasia, with the idea that perhaps in the future we could monitor the patients with minimally invasive devices and then identify those that require an endoscopy based on the use of biomarkers that are applied on the cellular component of the sample that focus on P53 and the degree of cellular atypia. So this is obviously a study going on, and hopefully we'll be hearing about the results soon.
So currently in the mainstream practice, we cannot use cytosponge as an alternative to OGD and biopsies.
Well, so we have presented the results of the sponge on the retrospective NHS England population. This was a study that looked at 800 people that had the capsular sponge and then had an endoscopy, and we looked at the concordance between the two. And actually, the data are incredibly promising. So in this particular study, the negative predictive value for dysplasia was 97%, and the positive predictive value was 38%, suggesting that you can effectively exclude patients without dysplasia, and then you can enrich in your population that is surveyed those with dysplasia. So as a matter of fact, in the UK, there are some centers that are using capsule sponge for surveillance, but this is part of a very well-controlled cohort where there is precise and strict auditing system in order to prospectively maintain and record the data. So I think the reason we cannot recommend at the moment capsule sponge for surveillance outside controlled practice, but I think this is something that I really am excited about hearing in the near future.
Okay, so it's clear outside these centers or audited controls, we have to do endoscopies. But is there any way we can prevent the burden on our histopathology colleagues with the amount of biopsies that we send? Can we not just do endoscopy and dye or AI and then reduce the amount of biopsies that we take? Are we there yet with that at all?
Yes, so I think this is a very difficult question to answer because, yes, as an expert endoscopy, I think that the majority of dysplasia can be seen endoscopically if you use a careful approach with electronic or diachrome endoscopy. But I think it's in our general practice, when we talk about non-expert or less expert field, it is really difficult to expect that everyone will be able to identify subtle changes on magnification endoscopy. And I think the current recommendation, I'm afraid, is to stick with the Seattle protocol and use that as a gold standard for recommending surveillance. Perhaps what we can do is to actually, once we are confident of our diagnosis, use, you know, longer intervals. Because I think in my practice, I still see a lot of patients being followed up every 2 years, where the recommendation is actually to see in 5 years if it's a short segment of Barrett. So I think it's important that we are familiar with the surveillance interval. And one way to reduce the burden is actually to use the correct intervals for surveillance.
Yeah, that would probably a better way of using the best use of health resources. Okay, one of the other ways, of course, is to stop surveillance. And that's, we are very poor at doing this in a publicly funded health systems. I think the default is always, yeah, it's easy to do a test rather than stopping. It's difficult to justify stopping or not doing something. And we as clinicians, probably mostly because of lack of time to sit down with our patients and explaining them to stop. So how would your approach be in stopping surveillance in terms of age, comorbidities, and all that?
Yeah, I think we need to really go by what we perceive is the benefit for the patient, right? So I think different guidelines have slightly different recommendation in here. So the European Society of Gastrointestinal Endoscopy recommends to consider stopping surveillance at the age of 75, particularly for those that have a life expectancy less than 5 years. In the UK, we don't have a hard cutoff for stopping surveillance. And I think the issue here is to really ask ourselves, are we making a favor? Are we benefiting patients with surveillance? And I think we have to look at their comorbidity burden. We have to look at their preference. We have to look at what the surveillance can bring to the patient. And I think if there is a perceived benefit, even in patients that are older than 80 years, which are not comorbid and they have a longer life expectancy, there is some benefit of doing surveillance. But certainly, I think we should have embedded in our practice that when we make an endoscopy report, because that's the opportunity where we see the patients, we have to make comments in our report that will help other physicians that might be looking at the results to take a synthesis of what the patient is like and what the results are, and then will help making an informed decision about whether continuing surveillance or not.
Yes, yeah. So I wish there was a simple formula just gives me, yes, surveillance or not. But we all know medicine is an art rather than just science. So we will have to take so many things into consideration. Thanks for telling us how you would approach. Now, when it comes to, I just want to go back to screening, not surveillance, screening for Barrett's, just for our listeners to make it clear. Why is it important? And how could this be done, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think screening is the single solution for the problem. But I think it does have enormous impact on our healthcare system because it's, as we said, it's just not feasible to do so many endoscopies. And we have to use ways to stratify the population. So we start with what the risk factors is, and the commonest risk factor for Barrett's and esophageal cancer is reflux. So one way is to focus on the population at reflux. And then if we see that these people have a high burden of other risk factors, then we could consider in a selected population an endoscopy. But on a population level, I think we need a non-endoscopic screening test that can identify the individuals at risk. Now, there is some good data from the BEST3 study, which has been conducted a few years ago in the UK, where people with reflux symptoms were randomized to either have the cytosponge or standard GP management. And that study did show that the use of cytosponge in the reflux population increased tenfold the yield of Barrett's diagnosis in the general population with reflux disease. So this is some important data. However, it does not show that ultimately we reduce the burden of mortality by esophageal adenocarcinoma. So I'm excited to say that there is now a study ongoing in the UK population, the BEST4 study, that will enroll 120,000 people with history of reflux symptoms who will be invited to receive cytosponge in mobile units around the country. These individuals will be randomized 2-to-1 to no capsosponge or capsosponge. And this study is expected to invite about 40,000 people for capsosponge. It will have 10 years follow-up and will hopefully prove whether or not minimally invasive screening can reduce the mortality by esophageal adenocarcinoma.
So the outcome measures for the BEST four, you're looking at the mortality benefit with screening.
Yes, so it's a composite endpoint including mortality and cancer stage.
Okay, lovely. So, Massey, I think we're coming to the end of our conversation. To conclude, is there any important or groundbreaking knowledge that's coming out or been recently out that we are not aware of in the mainstream in this field?
So I think we mentioned in the beginning, I mean, the side of the screening intervention we just discussed, I think there are two big studies that I really look forward to the results of. One is the PREFER study, which is looking at patients with T1B early adenocarcinoma, so invasive into the submucosa. And we heard the results at UEG last year, but the publication is still awaited, and that will give us some additional information as to what is the boundary of endoscopic therapy in patients with early esophageal adenocarcinoma. The other study which is awaited is the SANO study, also from Dutch investigators, and it's a study where patients with clinical remission, patients with esophageal adenocarcinoma treated with chemoradiotherapy, in clinical remission, whether we can actually monitor them and hold surgical intervention. So it's a de-escalation of treatment in people with the clinical response to chemoradiotherapy on a background of esophageal adenocarcinoma. I think, you know, these two studies together with the BEST4 study are probably going to significantly change in the near future the management of people with premalignant, early malignant, and malignant adenocarcinoma.
Thanks, Massey, for mentioning us that. Thanks for all your time today. I certainly learned a lot of things that I wasn't aware of, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners would benefit from the discussions that we've had today. Any final take-home points for our listeners?
Well, I think one thing that I would like to encourage everyone is to consider your endoscopy as a screening endoscopy at every time. Okay, so when performing a diagnostic endoscopy, that is your chance to identify early disease and prevent upper GI cancer. So take your time, and particularly in the esophagus, always I recommend my trainees to use narrowband imaging for exhibition, because narrowband imaging is an excellent imaging modality in the esophagus. It increases the contrast between Barrett's and normal esophagus, but also makes squamous dysplasia visible. And I know that we didn't have time to talk about squamous cell cancer and squamous dysplasia, but this is a condition which is often invisible on white light endoscopy. So use narrowband imaging in the esophagus. Take your time extubating these patients, because that is your chance to diagnose premalignant, early malignant esophageal condition, and you should take this opportunity every time.
Good point made there, Massey. Thank you so much for your time today, and hope you have a lovely day today.
Thanks, Pradeep, for having me, and I wish you all a good day.
Thank you.